face in the future. There will be a challenge from television that people will, that we are ready.
The preceding program was a pre-recorded presentation of WUSB Stony Brook.
Good afternoon and welcome to Chatterbox. I'm Eric Corley. I'll be with you for the next hour talking about all kinds of things. And this program includes you, our listeners. You're welcome to call us up at 246-7901. We know you're out there. It's up to you to prove it. It's been an interesting week. There have been all kinds of developments. The first week of the bottle bill is completed, and we all still seem to be here. However, there are numerous violations floating around, including ones very close to Stony Brook. Yes, if you see one, and that means stores that refuse to take back bottles or cans or things they sell, or only take them back for a short amount of time during the day, you should call this number, 360-4600. 360-4600 if you want to report anything wrong with people complying with a bottle bill or can bill, whatever you want to call it. Interesting things happened in the area. It's late September. I'm not quite sure of the date, but it doesn't really matter anyway. Friday night, I understand that WBAB Radio sponsored something at the Mad Hatters called Screw Russia Night. And we're going to try to look into that a little bit and see just what the hell that was all about. Remember, our number is 246-7901, and my guest for today is, I guess you could say, campus activist Mitch Cohen. If you've been around Stony Brook, you'll know who Mitch Cohen is. And we'll be talking with Mitch in just a moment, and you'll be talking with Mitch, too. Remember, our number is 246-7901. Before we get started, Mitch has asked me to play this song.
It's always the old lads to the war, always the young to fall. Now look at all we've won with a saber and a gun. Tell me, is it worth it all? For us to the final mission in the Japanese skies, set off the mighty mushroom roar. When I saw the cities burning, I knew that I was learning that I ain't a marching anymore. Now the labor leaders screaming when they close the missile plant. United fruit screams at the Cuban shore. Call it peace or call it treason, call it love or call it reason, but I ain't a marching anymore.
That's Phil Oakes from the Corrs of Fame album, I Ain't Marching Anymore. And, Mitch, what made you pick that song?
Well, that song was sort of an anthem for the New Left, which flourished in the country from around 1967 through the middle 1970s. And many of us who are active in the New Left, still active today, trying to create a freer and more peaceful world than the one we have now.
We're speaking with Mitch Cohen, who first came onto this campus in what year?
Started Stony Brook in September 1965, fresh from Stuyvesant High School in New York City.
Now, have you left at all since then?
I've been back and forth. I've traveled a bit.
Uh-huh.
Been in New York, traveled across the country several times.
Has there been a semester since then where your face has not been seen on this campus?
There were a few. There have been three times when I was banned from the campus.
Ah, but that didn't keep you away, did it?
Well, legally it did.
Legally, yeah. When did you graduate?
Let's see, I officially graduated around 1975, I think it was, in August. So that was 10 years that it took.
Now, was that an intentional graduation? It didn't happen by accident.
They changed the requirements.
Oh.
I didn't take any additional courses. They changed the requirements, which in turn allowed me to graduate.
Uh-huh.
Then at the graduation, I remember John Toll, who was the president of the university, was giving out the diplomas at that time. And there was a huge movement on campus. There were all sorts of cutbacks happening, and I tore up my diploma and threw it in his face and walked off the stage to the chagrin of parents and everybody else alike. The values were a little bit different.
I'd heard something about that, yes. They actually gave you the diplomas on the stage, or was it just
it was the piece of paper that allowed you to get your diploma.
Uh-huh. I see. That's interesting. Now, what did you major in?
I began as a math major.
Uh-huh.
And went through many of the sciences, which I was and still am interested in and try to keep up with. And I ended up as a liberal arts and English major. Yes, mainly liberal arts.
And how many credits would you say you have to your name from this place at this point?
Unofficially.
You're still taking classes now, right?
Well, not taking classes officially. I'm auditing some classes that I'm interested in, which I suggest that anybody who's interested in learning rather than the credits should do. Just go to classes that you're interested in, talk to the professor, and sit in. It's a good way to learn things that you don't know, and a good way to participate with other people in the learning process.
You have to get permission to do that, though, right?
Usually. But usually at Stony Brook, the classes are so big that the professors don't know you anyway.
Sure.
They don't know who's in the class.
But are those the best kind of classes to take?
Sometimes. Sometimes they are.
I did ask you something. I forget
right,
what it was.
I forgot what it was also.
Well, okay. It's so important anyway. But what is it about this place? What makes you hang around for so long? It's going on 20 years now.
Stony Brook was, back in the 60s and early 70s, was one of the most activist schools in the country. We had three people from Stony Brook were on nationwide strike steering committee for the 1970 strike following the murders at Kent State and Jackson State. We were the East Coast organizers. I was one of those people to organize against the war in Vietnam and against the political repression that was happening in the country, which was enormous. Many people have forgotten it today. And I feel that I could convey some of this history to people, and I have a base here. And everybody needs a community and a place to stay, and this is my home, just like anywhere else. It seems a little absurd in a way, but it's just as crazy a place as anywhere else or to be. And so there's a base here. So I organize here and try to pass along what I know and try to learn from others.
Now, what do you do with this organization?
I work for a group called Red Balloon Collective, which started at Stony Brook back in 1969. And we do a real lot of anti-war activity, anti-nuclear activity, involved in all sorts of freedom fighting organization.
Now, how many people are in that group?
Red Balloon's a collective, small handful of people. We never attempted to make it into a major mass organization. We're involved in many larger organizations. We were on the June 12th organizing committee for the huge rally in New York City. We were on the People's Anti-War Mobilization that put together the march against U.S. intervention in El Salvador in 1981 at the Pentagon. And we helped bring many people from Stony Brook to those demonstrations. We brought 5 busloads of people from Stony Brook in 1981 to the Pentagon to fight against U.S. intervention in El Salvador. And it doesn't compare quite with 1971, when we brought 2,500 people from the campus to Washington, D.C. in 1970, following the murders at Kent State and Jackson State. But people are still active. People are still concerned. There's a real lot to be learned and a real lot of commitment to be had.
Mm-hmm. Now, there are only a handful of people involved. Why is that? There must be about 30,000 people on this campus at one particular point.
Well, there are a handful involved in Red Balloon, which is only one narrow part of the spectrum, maybe 25 or 30 people involved. But there are many people involved in all sorts of different projects. There are women's centers. There are organizations for lesbian and gay rights. There's NYPIRG. There are many people involved in all sorts of different areas struggling to achieve a little bit more freedom than we have today, and trying to live their lives without being harassed and live more freely. And it happens in many areas. It's widespread. I think many of the values of the New Left have now inculcated in many people. It's totally different than it was in the early 60s or middle 60s when I started here. Not only in simple things like hair length or something like that, although I noticed there's a regression going on. But it's totally different in sexual attitudes and things that we expect in our own lives and how we live our own lives. Mm-hmm. Totally different. And I think that there's a instinctive distrust of hierarchical authorities that never existed. It took years and years for people to not trust the huge corporations. It took years for people to learn not to trust what our government tells us, including, for instance, what it's telling us on this plane that was shot down over Soviet Union.
We'll get to that. Oh, we'll get to that.
I'm sure people will have some things to call in about, too. I'd love to answer them.
Oh, yeah. Our number, by the way, is 246-7901. If you're out of the area code, the area code to put in front of it is 516. Now, you mentioned, Mitch Cohen, at one point that you were banned from the Stony Brook campus. Why? Were people afraid of you?
Well, apparently, and they're trying to do it again, which
they
is
are.
One of the things that I'm fighting against here with the head of, I guess it's called public safety now.
Uh-huh.
A man by the name of Barnes, who is at Kent State, just following the murders there, is now the head of public safety at Stony Brook. And there's another effort to ban me and probably other people like me who were considered to be troublemakers of some sort or another, even though the trouble that we raise is mainly in our words or mainly in trying to communicate to other people what we know.
Mm-hmm.
But I was banned in the past for anti-war activity. I was banned, I was declared persona non grata many years ago. I think it was 1969.
Well, no, I know in 1978, I believe it was, you were banned along with someone named Fred Friedman.
Right,
and
that was the latest one.
There wasn't a war going on then, was there?
There was a bookstore on campus that was not quite as... This bookstore is not quite as bad as the one that existed then, so you can imagine how bad it must have been then. And workers at the bookstore were trying to unionize, and they had succeeded in unionizing. And the company, including the Faculty Student Association at that time, fired some of the leading trade union organizers. And so we set up a picket of the bookstore, demanding that not only that bookstore company be removed from the campus because of the horrible way it was treating both the workers and the students, with the enormous prices in books and the lousy way it ordered books, often ran out for people couldn't study for their classes. So we set up a picket of the bookstore, and it lasted 8 weeks, in which we advised people not to buy from there. It was 80% successful. Its sales dropped by 80%. Mm-hmm. It was driven from the campus, but in the course of that struggle, there was an attempt to break it, to break the strike that was going on in the picket line. And one of the parts by by the faculty student administration in, at that time, in cahoots with the company that existed.
Well, how did they try to break the strike?
Well, one of the things that happened was that a young student came to the picket line. At this point in the day, there were only two people on it. We had staggered our shift. Sometimes there were 60 or 70 people. Sometimes there were two or three. And he physically attacked one of the people on the picket line, a person by the name of Hal, who is about 80 pounds or 90 pounds, and he jumped on this guy and started pummeling him. And I grabbed the person who's breaking the picket line and hitting Hal, and I grabbed him off and picked him up and held him against the door. And I literally was ready to smash him, no question about it, but I didn't. And he went limp in my arms. And nobody goes limp in your arms when you're about to get smashed.
Yeah.
And something instinctively in my mind said, watch out, this is a setup. You're being set up for something. So I instinctively just pushed him away, pushed him into the bookstore, and didn't touch him. And as soon as I had done that, about 5 or 6 seconds later, public safety, that time they were called security, came in through every doorway in the union. There were three main entrances, and two or three cops came in through every doorway looking for the incident. Where's the fight? What's going on? And, of course, there was no fight at that time. And the whole thing was a big setup. They helped him write his papers up, and he sued me in court, and we sued him back in court. He sued me for harassment. We sued him for assault and battery. And eventually he agreed to drop the charges against me and against Hal, who was lying unconscious on the floor, and we in turn agreed to drop the charges against him. We don't think that courts are an appropriate way of dealing with these type of problems, so we agreed to drop it. And but in the course of that, I was banned until the situation was resolved. And when it finally was resolved, the attorney general allowed me to come back on campus, although some of the university officials have consistently tried to keep me off as a result, using that as an excuse or a pretext.
Any particular enemies you care to name?
Mainly Barnes. Francis is no bargain either in there. I think Marburger means well in what he's doing here. I think he has some good ideas, but he has to stand up to his underlings, the people who he appointed, a lot more strongly than he does.
Who's your favorite administrator?
I don't have any favorite administrators.
You must have one. One that doesn't annoy you at all, that's always stayed out of your way.
Well, it's hard to pick one out of the rotten morass that's up there. I never had any run-ins with Homer Neal, for instance. I don't know if he's my favorite administrator. I know nothing about him, but never had any run-ins with him. Last semester, there were some potential situations when they fired Brett Silverstein, who is a popular psychology teacher.
Why here? He's still teaching here.
Well, this is his last year. He got 1 year notice.
Oh, okay.
And he was a very popular teacher who was an activist in his own way, and he was refused tenure by the psychology department, told to move on.
Do you think that was because he was an activist?
I think partly because he was an activist, partly because he didn't fit into the old boys' school. You know, they have this sort of way of relating to each other, which is also very sexist very often. Brett didn't fit the mold. He cared about the students. His office was always open to students to come in and talk with him. He was a good teacher. And since that time, since he was fired, allegedly for lack of research, one of his books has been published, or is in the course of being published by South End Press. Another book is in the works. You know, so what they were using to get rid of him, just like they used to get rid of me and also other people besides us, are false claims and false charges that they use over and over again, and because they don't want to direct themselves against the political in a direct manner, because that would be too upfront and too clear-cut. So they invent all sorts of false ways of trying to get rid of people who seem to have an effect in people's educational process here.
You've claimed credit for chasing an evil bookstore off campus and for supporting Mr. Silverstein. Could you sum up what else you've done for this campus?
Sure. What have we done for this campus or to this campus?
Well, both, actually.
There are many things that political activists have done over the years and social and educational activists that we've done over the years. For one, there were no daycare centers back in 1970 and 71, and we helped, along with people from an emerging women's center, to fight to get the daycare center that existed for a long time in Benedict College, which was the first one on campus, and it was the only parent-run and worker-run daycare center. People have this impression that all you have to do is write a letter with an effective sounding proposal and somehow it will be granted, not realizing that these things have to be fought for, as you who work with the bottle bill and other things have realized over and over again, that things have to be fought for in order to be won, and when the people stop fighting for them when they're already won, they often get taken away again. The daycare center took a year, a little more than a year of fighting to achieve so that women could be freed up, mainly women because of the way our society functions, of having to day in and day out take care of the children and would be free to go to work and pursue their careers as well. There are many other, any number of things, mainly centered around anti-nuclear and anti-war work that went on. Huge demonstrations, huge protests. We did help to end the Vietnam War here as well as elsewhere. We did help to put a damper in the plans to have ROTC on campus, which had been
when was this in the works.
It's been in the works every few years. It comes up again, and each time we fight against it, and so far we've been successful. ROTC is Reserve Officers Training Corps, which trains young people to be officers in the U.S. Armed Forces. Unfortunately, those usually get sent to other lands like Lebanon or Nicaragua or El Salvador, and people end up dying and killing other people, for not for our interests or the interests of freedom, but for the interests of Exxon and big corporations. And I think that that's wrong. And we've helped prevent that over the years and helped bring the Vietnam War to an end.
What was the first thing that woke you up to all this activity when you got here? What were you like? Were you a naive freshman like most of us are?
Well, I started here when I was 16 years old. I was afraid to talk to girls. I was trembling for 2.5 years here. Just go to some of the dances, which used to be called moods on campus, and just sort of sit there and watch people dancing. And I was totally introverted when it came to any kind of social activities and social functions.
Seems
I was
overcome that pretty well.
In many ways.
A social function.
A club on the head and a few terms in jail help you do that.
Well, a social function on this campus just isn't a social function if Mitch Cohen isn't there. You know,
I don't know. That's
it's not
true.
An official one. An official Stony Brook.
Well, I don't like to see myself in that way. I don't like to see myself as the organizer on campus, which I'm not, or the political or educational or social activist, however you choose that. I think that's a dangerous way of thinking, because then people think that when they get rid of you, they could get rid of the movement.
Mm-hmm.
And that hasn't been true in the past. You think they would have learned that for the last time that they tried to ban me. There was a huge movement that continued on campus. I just bring a certain sense of history, I think, and a certain cohesiveness to some of the movements. But there are many people on campus, both in social and educational and political realms, who are keep going about their business and doing a lot of good things. It's not only Red Balloon, and it's not only myself by any stretch of the imagination. There are many people and many with many different perspectives. That's one of the neat things about a university environment, is it allows this to occur. It allows this freedom of expression and people to express themselves somewhat more than in other areas of the society, and as sort of a supermarket of ideas.
Mm-hmm. Again, we have Mitch Cohen, the... how would you define yourself? Campus activist? Is that doing justice?
Well, I'm more than a campus activist, for sure. I don't only stay on the campus. I helped organize farm workers for 5 years, migrant farm workers, both upstate and on Long Island. I've helped organize the J.P. Stevens boycott. So I'd see myself as somebody who's concerned with what's happening in the society at large and trying to help organize people to transform our society.
Well, in any event, we have concerned citizen Mitch Cohen. If you've ever been to Stony Brook, you've seen him. And now this is your chance to call up and ask any kind of a question you have on your mind. Please don't be afraid to be the first caller, because someone's got to do it, and we won't laugh at you, we promise.
Perhaps in the meantime we could put on the other...
Okay, sure. Well, we have another Phil Oakes song that we are going to get to. Let me give out the phone number, 246-7901, area code 516. I'd just like to ask you, before we go into anything else, with all this hullabaloo about the Korean Airlines, tell me what happened.
Well, I don't know for sure what happened any more than anybody else reading the papers.
In your view,
there is a way of putting two and two together. First of all, the loss of 269 lives is a terrible tragedy. whether it's aboard the Korean Airline plane shot down by the Soviet Union, or as a result of U.S.-backed armed aggression in Central America. But as the arms race, as it heats up, more and more needless deaths, I think, are bound to occur through mistakes in judgment, or the need to make hair-trigger responses, and out of callous disregard for human life, and people are rendered expendable in the service of some sort of imperialistic or strategic aim that goes on. But in the past few weeks, the American government has dominated discussion of the shooting down of the airline, and it's only in recent days that we're finding more and more holes in the story. We're finding more and more tapes that were transcribed improperly, more and more so-called garbled parts of the tape that took part between the airline pilot and Japan and others who taped it, that are coming to light, that show exactly the opposite of what the United States said happened. And there are many, many things along that.
Well, let's speculate a little bit. What could have happened over there?
There's no question that the plane was shot down by the Soviet Union, whether it was from another airplane or from a ground-to-air
missile.
Okay,
that much we could say happened.
Yeah. What was the plane doing there? How did it get 300 to 400 miles off course? Was it correct to shoot it down, even if it was a spy plane, is part of the question. But then what is the role also of the United States in this, running spy missions right off the coast of the Soviet Union over a very sensitive area? Was this plane part of a whole spy pattern? I want to make clear that in no way in what I say, I think the revulsion horror of most Americans are well justified, but I think we're also falling into a trap, as we do over and over again, seemingly never to learn to not to believe our own government. Recent revelations have at least brought up serious questions about who is to blame, why we were lied to, and what really occurred. And there are all sorts of formally concealed or distorted facts that I don't see presenting them as in any way letting off the Soviet Union from the hook, but rather my intention is to present evidence that's both sobering and truthful in the hope that an active movement of the people, both of the Soviet Union and the United States, can turn back this mad direction, this mad insanity towards nuclear war, towards building up our armed forces, which helped cause this accident, towards intervention in Nicaragua and in El Salvador, and that we can turn this back as a way to prevent future tragedies like this from happening, instead of escalating it, instead of going out for blood, instead of saying, we've got to do this, when in fact the United States was partly the problem behind this whole shooting down of that plane.
Mm-hmm. Now, how do you reach the Soviet people?
Well, that's
always been a problem.
My concern is to reach the United States people, the people of the United States. The problem is here. The problem is that it's the United States that's in Central America.
The problem is only here?
I think that the Soviet Union has to curtail development of its nuclear weapons, too. But it's made many overtures to do that, that the United States has turned down flatly. I think as if the United States would have the guts or the chutzpah to begin take the first initiative, that the Soviet Union will very likely follow suit. And if it doesn't, then we could decide from there where to go. But the United States keeps refusing to make that first gesture, while the Soviet Union has said many times that it will not launch a first strike, no matter what. The United States has refused to go along with that or to make a similar claim for ourselves. It is said that we'll get rid of a certain portion of its SS-20s if the U.S. doesn't put in the cruise and Pershing missiles into Europe. It's made that gesture. It's even said that it will move all of its SS-20 missiles behind the Ural Mountains, so that the furthest they would be able to reach would be the Soviet Union's own borders if the United States wouldn't put in the cruise and Pershing missiles in Europe. And the U.S. still has not responded to that. So while I'm no fan of the Soviet Union at all and highly critical of many of the things that go on there, and I don't find it a model for socialism in the United States, and I say this as a socialist and as a Marxist, I do think that the United States itself has many things to answer for, and we have to focus here on moving our own government, economy, and people to bringing about changes here at home.
Now, would you say it's easier to bring about these changes here or for somebody in the Soviet Union to do the same?
I think that we have to go on what's happening here at home. I think that we have to, and that they will be picked up by people in the Soviet Union. But I see that our country is performing heinous crimes in the world against people who are simply fighting for their own freedom to determine for themselves how they want to go, whether that way is communist, whether that way is capitalist, whether that way is no-ism at all. But it's people trying to determine for themselves how they want to live in our country for one reason or another, sometimes for so-called strategic purposes, sometimes because Exxon has profits invested there or Chase Manhattan has profits, are willing to sacrifice our lives and the lives of people abroad so that they can make an extra dollar or two off of a barrel of oil. And I think that's a horrible crime, and the people have to come before profits.
Keep those calls coming in, 246-7901. Mitch, you said that you didn't consider the Soviet Union to be a model of Marxism. Are there
right.
any?
I consider myself a Marxist.
But are there any models of Marxism around
now, within
that?
Within each country, certainly there are some countries that have, with each passing revolution, have begun to develop more fully and more freely what I would consider to be a more socialistic direction. Whether they've actually achieved socialism or not is a fine point of debate among Marxists ourselves. I think what's happening in Nicaragua is totally opposite of the way that the U.S. government has portrayed it. You could read in some of the papers, even the New York Times, articles of what the educational system now in Nicaragua, where they've wiped out a huge amount of the illiteracy that existed under the previous U.S.-backed dictatorship by the name of Somoza. That literacy was 50%, now it's down to 12% in just 4 years. The U.S. claims that they haven't had elections in Nicaragua, and therefore it's a dictatorship. Well, they've just begun to have opposition parties form in the past 2 weeks. Elections are scheduled for next year. And we must remember that after our own revolution in 1700s, it took 6 years before we were consolidated enough as a people to even have our first election, in which George Washington became the president of the United States, after initially being offered the job of king, which he turned down. So we have to keep in mind that there's a process that goes on before elections take place, and that's happening in Nicaragua. Now, I don't think Nicaragua is a model for the United States either. I think each people determine for themselves how they want to live and how they want to go. And we as a people are far from determining that for ourselves. We have no say over the economy of this country. Nobody voted to be unemployed. Nobody voted to live under the conditions that they live under. We're forced to choose from equally unmeaningful choices in elections.
But can people vote for those kind of meaningful things anywhere?
Sure, you could. Well, can they vote anywhere? People don't only vote in election booths. They vote with their feet. They vote with having control over their economy. They vote in different ways. And yes, I think that exists in many countries of the world. Not only in socialist countries, but even somewhat more in some of the social democratic or capitalist countries that have sort of a social conscience that was dragged out of them by workers fighting over the years and years. Again, none of these things were granted. These things had to be won pride, tooth and nail from the people in power.
There are a lot of different trouble spots in the world right now. Which one do you focus most of your attention on? Which one do you think is going to blow up first?
Well, I think the United States is going to blow up first, but I think there's so much tension that's happening now with people, poor people, unemployed people, people living under poverty. People don't realize that over 25%, according to the government's own figures, of people in the United States live under the official and very low poverty ceiling declared by the U.S. government itself.
Now, can you give me indications that there's trouble brewing, you know, from all this?
Well, it depends how you define trouble. Where people are starving to death, that I consider that to be trouble. Whether they're going to uprise or not, create a revolution or not, that remains to be seen. I'm not an advocate of any particular method of dealing with this type of problem. I just look to see what people are doing and help to support that wherever possible so that people can rise above the conditions of their lives, including, in different ways, the conditions of our own lives at Stony Brook, and many people here are from middle-class families, but there are different types of problems that plague people here. And there still does not, if you took a survey on campus and asked people how many people are happy on campus, I reckon that you would find very few people who would say that they're happy in their lives. Why do people come to Stony Brook these days? Mainly to get a good job, because they're worried about the jobs that they'll have when they get out of school. They're not here so much to receive an education and to learn just for the sheer joy of learning. They're not here in order to try and help people who are in less fortunate positions than they might be. They're here because they're worried about surviving. And that's a very sad commentary on the nature of our society when young people, people who are still in their teens, have to worry in such a significant way about what's happening in their lives.
Uh-huh.
I think people are very sad in their lives. I think that they objectify each other. They treat each other as objects. They treat each other as sort of almost as drugs. They use drugs not for for what revelatory experiences can be obtained through them, but they use drugs in an abusive way to escape from having to deal with many of the things that are concerning their lives in the world. The whole world becomes a television show, a spectacle, to which, if you don't like it, you're taught maybe we can change the channel. But there's no channel to turn to anymore. There's nowhere to turn. You could choose between Carter or Reagan and get very little choice between the two in the last election. You get somebody like Carter, who they do have slightly different policies, that's true, but Carter began the Trident submarine, the B-1 bomber, the cruise missiles, the Pershing missiles were begun under Carter, the MX missile, the draft, everything that Reagan has taken today and expanded upon were begun under Carter. There is some difference in emphasis, but there is no real difference in what they're trying to accomplish. And so we don't really have that much of a choice. And the people of Central America have even less of a choice now, as the United States is pouring tons of resources down into, quote, our backyard, which why not see us as their backyard, since they were probably here first, but besides that. So they have very little choice in what's happening now with the pressure the U.S. is putting on. And we'd like to see that pressure relieved and people have determined for themselves how they want to live, including here at home.
We're going to go to that second song that you want us to play.
It's more apropos for students, and it addresses a lot of the questions that students have.
Yeah.
And the being made into a number, being made into a social security identity card number, and less of a person as you become part of a faceless crowd and not an individual.
Yeah. What's the name of the song?
Which song is it? What's that I know? I forget what the name of it is.
I'm going to say it now. You want to describe it?
No, go ahead.
Okay, we'll just play it then.
It still loves itself. It's wonderful.
Just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rise and smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Well, you've given me a number, and you've taken off my name. To get around this campus, why, you almost need a plane. And you're supporting Chiang Kai-shek while I'm supporting Mao. So when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I wish that you'd make up your mind, I wish that you'd decide that I should live as freely as those who live outside. Cause we also are entitled to the rights to be in doubt. And when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Would you like to be my father, you'd like to be my dad, and give me kisses when I'm good and spank me when I'm bad? But since I left my parents, I've forgotten how to bow, so when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. And things, they might be different if I was here alone. But I've got a friend or two who no longer live at home. And we'll respect our elders just as long as they allow. That when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. I've read of other countries where the students take a stand. They've even helped to overthrow the leaders of the land. Now I wouldn't go so far to say we're also learning how, but when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. So keep right on a-talking and tell us what to do. But if nobody listens, my apologies to you. And I know that you were younger once, cause you sure are older now. And when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now. Oh, I'm just a student, sir, and only want to learn. But it's hard to read through the rising smoke from the books that you like to burn. So I'd like to make a promise, and I'd like to make a vow, that when I've got something to say, sir, I'm gonna say it now.
Back to the phones, 246-7901.
Now, and that's the number, 246-7901. Let me give that number one more time. I fear it might not have gone out over the air. 246-7901. And we have Mitch Cohen with us. You there, Mitch?
I'm here.
Okay, let's talk about something that's quite common in this place, and that's apathy. There's apathy all over the place, all over the campus, all over the country, hell, all over the phone lines, you know.
I don't believe that there's apathy.
People don't call because they're afraid to get involved, you know. Do you think that's the reason?
I think that's part of the reason. I think part of the reason is that people are afraid that they're not apathetic. I think when confronted with things that they see that they agree are bad, and they see them in front of themselves and in front of their eyes, people are willing to do something about it. I've seen people take the shirt off their back when they had nothing and give it to other people to help them out. I don't believe there's apathy. I believe people are beaten down into a form of complacency. In a way, it's a form of defeat. But I don't believe that people don't care about other people or about what's happening in their own lives or in the lives of other people. No.
Well, all I have to say is, folks out there, prove that you care. Give us oh, that got it ringing. Oh, the phone's ringing now. Anyway, 246-7901 is our phone number. Let's hear from you. USB, you're on the air.
Yeah, I have a question. Given what's going on in the country these days, economically and everything, is it still a central or task, or is it important a thing for people to do to really be organizing students? And why does Mitchell, who's been around the campus for a long time, feel that it's still an important task to try to deal with students? And does he view students as politically a credible force as they were, say, 15 years ago?
Well, for one, students don't always stay as students. Students go out and they take jobs and they go out into a workforce. Most students from Stony Brook, contrary to popular belief, don't get the great jobs, don't get the engineering jobs, and they have to end up being waiters and waitresses. They end up being secretaries. Some end up being teachers, and they help teach others, and they pass along a lot of the education that they might receive here. And at Stony Brook, I think a lot of people's and in other universities, people's values help get formed. It's a chance where people can experiment with each other in new, different types of lifestyles, and we could experiment in different ways of learning. And there's time to read, and learning is a crucial aspect that many people don't do outside of the university or school context. I know I read much more when I was a student and now when I'm at a university than I do when I have a full-time job. You come home from the job and you're exhausted. You're tired. You don't have time to do many of the things that we would like to do or that are necessary to do. So there's a chance for people to learn things. But I don't think that student organizing is the only thing or necessarily even the most important thing to be doing. That's up for reassessment. And I think many people around the country, including myself, are reassessing that. That is one of the areas, but it's not the only area at all. But it's also students are able to provide shock troops for things. Students are able to go out to Shoreham and demonstrate against the nuclear power plant. Students are able to, there's a community, people feel a sense of community here that enables people, students as well as faculty members here and the people who work on the campus, to take part in the activities that they probably normally don't do without a much greater effort being expended when they're living a different lifestyle than that of a student. So I think that's important. And equally important, I think people are able to experiment with their lives. Certainly people's sexual identities begin being developed at living in dormitories or living in alternative living arrangements outside of the nuclear family, outside of the nuclear power plant, and the nuclear family seem to go hand in hand in some ways. But I think that people learn new ways of relating, or can learn. The potential is there for people to learn new ways of relating. And I think that's crucial if we're ever going to make any changes at all in this country and in this world.
Given the amount of time that you spent on campus seeing the different types of changes that have occurred, when do you think there was something that you could call a dramatic shift, or was the process so slow into what I would view as the sort of more conservative consciousness of the day?
Well, I remember sitting around in the student union, just as people do now, way back in 69 and 70 when there was, looking back, it seems that there was an enormous amount of student activity. And I remember sitting there going, oh man, what are we going to do? There's a war going on, and Nixon's about to bomb Cambodia secretly and illegally. And I remember when it came on the air and that happened, and we were thinking, what are we going to do? Nothing will move these students. And then when Nixon bombed Hanoi and Haiphong Harbor, and the same thing happened. What are we going to do to move people? People are not going to move. I think we've tended to romanticize an era of time, and which is the 60s, and I don't think that today is all that much different.
Well,
from
I
the
can 60s. Remember sitting around some of those, if not the same tables, slightly different location, same basic setting. And while that's true, there we were speaking to a power of 10 greater the numbers of our base organization. So I remember sitting around a table where you're talking about the 150 or 200 or 300 or 500 or 1,000 people you could rely upon to come to a demonstration, as opposed to the 10 or 20 or 30 who you can rely upon at this point. So I think that while you're right, our sense of what was going on is in some way fairly similar. The scale was still dramatically larger, and I'm wondering when, for you, you saw, if anything, a change in that.
I think that probably has something to do with the fact that there was a full-fledged war going on then, as opposed to now, when there are a lot of different issues. There isn't one big thing.
I think, in addition to that, I agree with that, that we tend to look at the 60s with reverence in a way, and in many ways...
I'm not particularly happy
right.
that there was a war on.
Right.
I mean, I don't glorify... It's the good old days are not good old days because there was a war being fought.
Right. But there were also... I think many people learned that the demonstrations, the public demonstrations, reach a certain point after which they don't seem to do very much, the type of rallies and places like New York City and Washington, D.C., even though they're still important, and even though I'm going to put in a plug for the rally in Washington, D.C. on November 12th, which is, again, sponsored by all the El Salvador and Nicaragua groups in the country to help stop U.S. intervention in the Central America, and I think people should go on November 12th. There's also a feeling that no matter what we do in terms of rallies or speech or talking, that they're not going to listen to us because they have different interests at stake. And it's only when they being the powers that be, the government, the large corporations, when they feel threatened by some larger force, that maybe people are going to take over the factories and take them away from them, take away their livelihoods, only then do they begin to give in a little bit. But it's not until then that the demonstrations really have any effect or rallies. And so there's been a new development in the past 4 years that didn't exist before, and that's the form of, at least it didn't exist in the past like 15 years, and that's more direct action-oriented things. Sitting in blockades, blockading research institutes like Lawrence Livermore Laboratory, which helps make components for all the U.S. missiles and nuclear devices, or helps do the thinking behind it. And sitting at laboratories in Chicago and corporations, General Electric in New York City, that help produce these things. That there's a new understanding that exists among many people. That's part of that demonstrations failed, so why do anything about it? Even though I don't think they fail in general, but in these circumstances, I think that there are other things that can be done as well. And that people realize this intuitively. And all those people who do realize it take part in direct actions, but many people feel that there's nothing that they can do to change what's happening. It's not that they don't care about what's happening, but what can I do
You can't fight City Hall. What can we do to change it? There's nothing we could do. And on the other hand, these same people also believe that we live in the freest country in the world, that we have a democracy. So they hold that in their minds. And also in their minds is that there's nothing we can do. Or if we do anything, the FBI will create a file on us, or we'll lose our job or be blacklisted. And both of these exist simultaneously in people's minds, in many people's minds, and create real crisis, anguish, problems. People don't know how to resolve that type of inherent contradiction or conflict in our minds.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks for answering the question.
All right, thank you for asking it.
Okay.
Thanks for calling. Goodbye.
Bye-bye.
246-7901 is our telephone number. Mitch Cohen is with us. He's our guest for today on Chatterbox. We have about 8 minutes left. You've been on Long Island for quite a while. How have you seen things change? I mean, I know the place is getting built up, but what specifically has been happening? Do you see an attitude change?
Well, I've been around Long Island both on and off the campus for many years. I think that people, and I'll say Port Jefferson has been built up. It's becoming ritzy, made ritzy. It looks like Brooklyn Heights. There are a lot of small, what used to be, as one of my friends used to put it, a quaint fishing village. It has now become all full of boutiques and places where people can get the same crap that they always got but pay twice as much money for it. And so a little boutique has lost its chic. And it's been a real... That's part of it. And there's been an attempt to build up like that. But on the other hand, people don't have as much money to spend as they used to have, many people. And so you have not only pockets of poverty around where people work on the farms and farm workers, but many farm owners themselves are in desperate situations. Many people, as there's been an industrialized effort on Long Island, many of those people who have become part of industry are now unemployed. And they're living on Long Island where that didn't exist before. So there's been, I guess what I would say is a polarization, an economic polarization, which has its ramifications in people's thoughts as well. That people become polarized in different directions as a result of what's happening to them in their lives. And that didn't exist before. I think that there are many people who are willing to try and stop what they see is happening when they think it's wrong. We had gone through Port Jefferson and Stony Brook many times 2 years ago when they were trying to introduce the neutron bomb, which was another Carter baby. And we had done several marches. Every week for 7 weeks we marched. And we would do die-ins at the end of the march, in which people would die in Chandler Square on Fort Jefferson, just lie down on the ground with our faces painted white and with a bomb. And many people, hundreds of people, would gather around wanting to know what we were doing, and then we would talk to people and explain what we were doing. And we found out that many people supported the neutron bomb decision by Carter, but that support was very shallow. And after we finished leafleting and talking with people week after week and involving people in activities, we found when we surveyed it afterwards that probably 70% of the people in that area had become opposed to the neutron bomb and as a consequence become opposed to large amounts of what the United States foreign policy was about abroad. And so the support that exists for Reagan's foreign policy or Carter's foreign policy, I find to be there, but it's shallow support. And it's when people speak up and let their other types of thinking be known, let their opposition to what's happening be known, that encourages many other people who are afraid of speaking up, who felt isolated, who felt, wow, I must be the only one who thinks in this freaky way. All of a sudden they realize that there are hundreds and thousands of people who think the same way. That became evident, say, on the June 12th march when 1 million people marched in New York City. And all of a sudden the issue of the nuclear freeze and rollback of nuclear weapons became very much on the air, very much exciting, and people who were afraid to talk about before now were talking about it everywhere, and people who had thought one way now suddenly were taking positions and living their lives in a slightly different way. And I think therefore that everybody has an obligation, who understands things, to speak up about that, not try to hide it, not be afraid, speak up, and we'll find that many other people feel the same way as we do, that it's not just a small minority, but in fact that we are the majority. And I don't think it's so much as a silent majority that we are. I think it's sort of a afraid majority. It's people who are afraid that what little we have will be taken away from us somehow, that somehow we will be put on files, or somehow we will lose our jobs. And these are, in some ways, legitimate fears, but they're fears that we could deal with when people aren't afraid to speak out. We can organize around them.
Mitch, we only have a couple of minutes in that time. I'd like you to tell us what you see for yourself in the future. What do you want to do?
I want to go to the Bahamas, man, and just hang out. Smoke good dope. Hang out in the Bahamas.
Think you'll be here another 20 years?
I don't know what is going to happen. I just advise people to get involved in whatever activist groups they see around them. Come to Washington on November 12th. Get in touch with this group called Freeze and Scream. There are groups like NYPIRG. There are groups like Red Balloon. They're all over the place. Different groups, not the same groups. Many different local groups all over the place. Get involved in your community. Change the world. Change our own lives in the process of changing the world. I think that we could create something different. Whether I'll be at Stony Brook or not, I don't know. If I'm not here, somebody else will be here to do the same thing I'm doing. Doesn't matter
much. I think one of the questions I get a lot from people regarding things like this, it would be very nice if a lot of us could do what you do and, you know, hang out and counsel people and get involved in everything that you want to get involved in. But how do you do it? How do you survive? You know?
I haven't quite figured that out yet. Any donations out there are more than welcome.
Well, you must be.
I haven't quite figured it out. I sell my poetry on the street in Brooklyn when the weather's nice out, and that's how I make enough money for food.
You survive on that?
I pay my food money off of that, but that's only in about half the year. The other half of the year, I haven't quite figured out how it's done yet, but I've managed to do it for, I don't know, 15 years now. I don't think it's anything exceptional. I don't feel I've made extravagant sacrifices. Things that might seem sacrificial from one end of it, from this end, seem like blessing in a way. It seems like it's joyous. It's affirming a life energy and a life force that I think is taken from us in many ways. So I don't quite know how it's done. I guess friends and people take care of you when you devote yourselves towards taking care of them. People help each other out as part of the human spirit to help each other out. And I think that happens a real lot, and I'm grateful to the people who do that. And I don't live on much either. I mean, what do I live on? $1,500 a year? It doesn't take much money, really.
That's possible to do that, huh?
Sure. And maintain my color TV and stereo and three-car garage and my Rolls Royce.
There have been rumors, Mitch. There have been all kinds of rumors about it.
I know. We get gold from Moscow, didn't you know? We buy pizza with it. If only that gold would arrive just once in my life, I would want to see it.
People on this campus think that you're independently wealthy, that you work for the CIA. I've heard it all.
Yeah.
I think I even heard the KGB ones. But
well, I think I'm independently poor. I'm permanently between jobs. I don't work for the CIA. Don't work for the KGB. KGB wouldn't want me any more than the CIA would want me. I think that, again, I want to stress that I don't think that the Soviet Union is any model for those of us who want to transform our country. That it's not a model for us, that there are many things to be learned from it, but many things to be scorned in it. Same thing in this country, in the way it's been set up. Not in the people of this country, but in the way the institutions and the callous way that and profit-making way that decides for us what our futures would be, instead of deciding because we're people and human beings and have certain needs, that people have to come before profits.
Mitch Cohen, I want to thank you for being with us.
And I want to thank you.
Today on Shatterbox. And good luck, whatever you end up doing. And
thank you.
Have fun, too.
Sure.
Next week, tune in again, Monday, 2:30 p.m., for another edition of Shatterbox, when we'll be talking to another interesting person. Until then, this is Eric Corley. Good day.